Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Democratic presidential candidates are preparing to debate next week. Republicans have already had two of them. What role do debates play in the presidential campaigns? We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But first, a discussion about the kind of country the next president will preside over or might preside over. Our first guest is Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, who is currently teaching public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also a prolific author, and his latest book considers what he sees as a threat to our society as we know it. He says the economic deck is stacked against us by the people who make the rules, the wealthy and big corporations. The title is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. Professor Reich's book will certainly make you think, and it might make you angry. Robert Reich, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Good to be here, Don. Thank you.
Well, the title of the book is Saving Capitalism. How is it threatened?
It's threatened because most people in this country are on a downward escalator. Adjusted for inflation, their wages and compensation have been lessening. Their job security is jeopardized. Most people are living really paycheck to paycheck. Two-thirds of Americans, paycheck to paycheck. Meanwhile, almost all the gains from economic growth in this economy are now going to people at the very top. I don't mean to vilify them at all. They're not bad people. But what has happened is the system as a whole is no longer working for most people. And historically, in the United States, when that happens, that is, when the system, the political economic system we're in, gets off track, we don't do what other countries historically have done. They succumb to either communism or fascism or totalitarianism. We have a tradition of reforming ourselves. And I think that a wave of fundamental reform is coming.
Well, really, what makes you say that? What do you see?
Well, I see a variety of things. Number one, this election so far has been very interesting. I think Bernie Sanders, and also in a very different vein, I hate to use them both in the same sentence, but also Donald Trump, represent a kind of anti-establishment candidates, both in the Republican and Democratic parties, that were unpredictable to most people, although in my book I did say the future is going to be anti-establishment politics, not Democrat versus Republican. It is really going to be a populist upsurge. It happened a little bit earlier than I was counting on. Also, as I go around the country, and I've been on book tour only for a week, but I've spent a lot of time, as much time as I can, in the heartland, in red states, so-called, talking with people who call themselves conservatives. I hear them say things like, we've got to stop crony capitalism. We've got to get rid of corporate welfare. We've got to bust up the big banks on Wall Street. And if I listen to them and don't know that they are Tea Partiers or conservatives, I think I'm listening to somebody who's a left-wing populist. And then finally, I spent a lot of time with students. I teach. Last night I was at the University of Chicago, not a bastion of liberalism. And yet the students I come across, even at Chicago, are overwhelmingly, let's use the term, populist. They really are determined to change the system so it works for everyone and not just a tiny group at the top.
Well, one of the main points you make in your book is that the people at the top, the elites, the 1% as we now call them, it's actually less than 1%, I think, really controlling most of the wealth, but they're the ones that make the rules, and the rules are always designed to give them the advantage. What kind of rules are we talking about here?
The basic rules of capitalism, the building blocks of capitalism, I mean, even property. You know, the property is now, the most valuable form of property is intellectual property. It's patents and trademarks. And what has happened is the patents have been lengthened, and many patent holders are paying. If you're a pharmaceutical company, for example, you are now allowed to pay generic pharmaceutical companies to delay the introduction of generics. You also have got a big payoff from the federal government if you're a pharmaceutical company, in the sense that the federal government has agreed not to use its bargaining leverage under Medicare to get lower prices. Or you look at other forms of property or contract or even bankruptcy, Don. I mean, bankruptcy is something people's eyes glaze over. You talk about bankruptcy law. But it's interesting. It's important because here, too, the wealth and the powerful big corporations, Wall Street, they've changed bankruptcy laws so that it's very easy, relatively, for a big corporation or a billionaire to shield itself or himself from liabilities, from bad bets by using bankruptcy. But if you're a homeowner who gets caught in the downdraft of a recession, or if you're a former student who has a huge burden from student loans, you are no longer able to use bankruptcy at all. You can't reorganize your debts. In other words, we could go through every area of the market, and what we see is something that's called the market that a lot of people assume is sort of neutral and those market forces are outside the political realm. Actually, those market forces are determined by rules, and those rules have been changed over the last 30 years to help the people at the top and to cost the rest of us more.
See, I thought all of these points you make in your book and spend a lot of time doing that, but I thought you would go right to the political system, the Citizens United, and the fact that big money is going to the politicians. Who are the people who make the rules?
Well, you have to, first of all, establish in people's minds something that they don't really all the time think about, and that is that their issue and choice is not free market versus government. Government is shaping the market. You can't have a market without government. And once you understand that, once you understand that the rules of the market are constantly being revised, and they're being revised by judges, legislators, and agency heads, and that big money coming down through campaign contributions and through lobbying and through a variety of other ways is influencing what those rules are going to be, then you see the connection between wealth and power and how the economy is functioning.
But you know, and I know you address this in the book as well. It's a great read, by the way. I'm recommending it to people I know. It's something people should be reading. But one of the points that you make in the book concerning these lobbyists and these people that we're talking about here is that they're doing it without any real obstacle, without any opposition, making the rest of us feel powerless.
Absolutely powerless. I think that powerlessness is really the way most Americans now look upon not only the economy. You know, I can't do anything. People say I work for a company. I'm powerless as an employee, or I work on my own, and I'm subjected to a lot of these market forces, and I have no security at all. Or even vis-a-vis politics and government, most people feel like I have no control. I don't even want to get involved. It's all corrupt. But you see, that powerlessness and that feeling of powerlessness and cynicism can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if people turn their backs on politics and say there's nothing that can be done, then the moneyed interests get it all. And I'm beginning to see a change. I mean, I think that it's fair to say a couple of years ago most people did feel nothing could be done. But now, as I suggested, there is an American tradition of people, when we get off track, joining together and making changes. And I think we are near the cusp of something that might be called a populist upsurge.
Going back to the current political climate, obviously, it would seem that that Bernie Sanders and his campaign right now and his philosophy is very much in line with yours and the things you're saying in this book.
Well, I'm not going to either talk about any particular candidate. Mm-hmm. I don't in the book. I have known Hillary Clinton since she was 19
sure.
years old. In fact, I even, if you can keep this just between us, Don, I dated her once
really?
In college.
Before
she met Bill Clinton. I have enormous faith in her. I think she's a wonderful person. She'd make a great president. But I am also very enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders. He's saying things that have to be heard. He's speaking truth. I also think that there's a different current of populism in the world. Every time there's an upsurge, when people feel like the economy and politics are out of control, it's not just progressive reform populism that sometimes takes hold. Sometimes what takes hold might be called authoritarian populism, where you have a strongman who says, follow me because I am tough and powerful and big and I will change everything. And by the way, your problems are due to them, that group over there, it's those scapegoats.
We've heard this song before.
Well, we have heard it before, mm-hmm. and history is filled with some very ugly examples of mm-hmm. what happens. But there are two faces to populism. Let's not get too excited about populism as a whole. It's got to be, hopefully, fundamental reform.
Fundamental reform, which means if people have to put on the pressure. And that's where problems can arise. I mean, how, under your thinking, do people band together, galvanize to affect this change?
We used to have countervailing power in the right. United States. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist and political philosopher who was my mentor, in fact, I dedicated the book to him, wrote a book in 1952 called American Capitalism, The Concept of Countervailing Power, in which he posited that the reason the economy of those days was working so well and so many more people were becoming prosperous, the middle class was growing, even poor people were rising into the middle class, was because we had strong countervailing power. We had labor unions, and those unions were becoming stronger and stronger. They could bargain on behalf of average working people. We had farm cooperatives. We had local banks that could balance the power of Wall Street. We had all sorts of institutions at the local and state level that really were able to make capitalism work for most people. And the big problem, I believe, over the last 30 years is that many of those institutions have withered. They have lost their power. And the only way, it seems to me, to countervail the power of the big corporations and the big banks and the billionaires is to resource, redevelop, reignite countervailing power.
Did the unions lose their power, or was it taken from them by the group that we're talking about at the top?
Well, we can debate whether they lost it willingly or unwillingly. I think probably unwillingly. In 1955, 35% of American workers in the private sector were unionized. Today, fewer than 7% in the private sector are unionized. You can't negotiate and bargain for a larger share of the benefits of economic growth if you're in the middle class, lower middle class, or working class, or even poor, if you don't have unions representing a large segment of the American workforce.
After World War II, when unions were strong, that's when the middle class was thriving.
Absolutely.
Where is it now? I mean, where would you place the middle class now in the overall scheme of things?
Well, the middle class is shrinking.
Oh, yeah.
The median wage adjusted for inflation today is lower than it was in 1978. I mean, consider that. The American economy is almost twice as large as it was then. But most people, if you adjust for the cost of living, are actually not doing as well. I grew up in a very modest household. You know, my father ran a clothing store downtown. But we had enough, and he earned enough to have to buy a house. We had two cars. We had everything that we needed. Well, that's hard today. You know, you have to have two incomes, and a lot of people can't afford a house, and it's very, very difficult to get by.
You also point out that in real dollars, the minimum wage 20 years ago was more than it is today.
Yes,
in terms of real dollars.
In fact, if you took the minimum wage in 1968 and merely adjusted for inflation, that is, just kept it absolutely constant, it would be $10.60 today. You know, meanwhile, you've got CEOs of big companies who in the 1960s were earning 20 times what the average worker was earning. Today, they're earning 300 times what the average worker is earning. We're seeing, Don, the development of two groups in the American economy, both of which raise the question of, are we doing it right? Raise the moral question about capitalism. One group is the working poor. You know, it used to be that if you were working full time, you were not poor. Mm-hmm. We used to believe that somebody who works 40, 50, 60 hours a week should not be poor. Now you have more and more and more people who are working and poor. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a large and growing number of people, not that large, but still significant, who are non-working rich, who are the heirs or the grandchildren or great-grandchildren of fortunes, and they don't even know what it is to work.
It's now, inherited wealth.
Inherited wealth is getting to be a big big part of the American economy. So you've got these two groups, the working poor and the non-working rich, and they both run counter to our values about our meritocracy, about what work should result in.
I have to take a break, but I also want to point out another figure you have in your book, and that is that 43% of the people who are born in poverty today will die in poverty.
And that's a very, very high number.
Oh.
That's higher than it is in most European countries. We pride ourselves on kind of Horatio Alger rags to riches, mm-hmm. the notion that anybody can make it in America with enough guts and gumption. Well, when you have 43% of young people who are born into poverty who will never get out of poverty, that is a very blistering it's not an indictment. I mean, it ought to make us uncomfortable.
And I'm sure it does to many people. We'll come back and pick up on that point. I want to localize it if I can when we come back. Our guest in studio is Robert Reich. He's the former Secretary of Labor and also author of the new book, Saving Capitalism for the Many and Not the Few. Back to continue the conversation, and if you want to be a part of it, give us a call at 382-8255, and we'll try to get you into it. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary and author of the book, Saving Capitalism for the Many and Not for the Few. I'd like to pick up, Professor Reich, on the poor people points that you were just making before the break and localize it to the extent of, I'm sure you're familiar with what happened here in Ferguson last year after the shooting death of that young man, Michael Brown. I wonder if you see this. A lot of that was the demonstrations and the subsequent discussion centered on economics and the fact that there were obvious problems with that population. Is this part of what you're talking about? Is this part of the uprising, the part of the galvanizing that has to happen to effect change?
It is part of it, Don. I mean, we are seeing minorities in this country who certainly suffer structural prejudice and racism. But that's not all they suffer. They're also suffering the consequences of an economic system that is increasingly stacked against them and also against the working class and against the middle class. And for too long, certain politicians and certain political parties have tried to divide us by race and by ethnicity and say, well, the reason that you white working class are doing badly is because of them. But in fact, that is a distraction from what's really happening.
I have here from the book, the feeling of powerlessness, which we talked about a moment ago, fuels racism, anti-immigration, and political instability. That's kind of what you're saying here.
Exactly. And we have when the middle class and the working class are under great stress, and we know this has happened before in our country, that is fodder. That is the seedbed of demagogues who want to use that anger and that resentment and channel it against racial minorities or against foreigners or against immigrants or against anybody who can easily be singled out as a kind of a scapegoat, when in fact it is a major and a very fundamental distraction from the larger economic pattern that has occurred.
That's where we are right now. I mean, look at Donald Trump. Let's build a wall. I mean, that's just part of the equation. Lots to talk about. I'd like to get the audience into the discussion, and we'll start by bringing in Dan, calling from Creve Coeur. Dan, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Dan, are you there?
Having me. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it was basically a comment that, you know, the working class has now been convinced by, I think, you know, huge amounts of money poured into, you know, the media, which that basically they're turning against the institutions which empower the masses versus the very, you know, unions. You know, they're for tort reform. You know, a lot of people who say they're populist are like, oh yeah, we got to get rid of the courts. Well, the courts are like the only way that, you know, the working class has to meet on even a playing field, whether it's a level playing field or not, with the corporate class, with, you know, the class of the rulers. And the same is true with OSHA. You hear so many people saying, oh, OSHA's so horrible. Well, I mean, you get your finger cut off and OSHA isn't horrible anymore, you know? Anyways, that's my comment.
Well, thank you, Dan. I agree with you, obviously, completely. We are seeing that kind of divide and conquer strategy through what is propaganda and what happens. And again, I don't want to paint with such a broad brush that anybody who is wealthy thinks that I'm indicting them or penalize or in any way criticizing them. But that's not the point. The point is that when you have huge amounts of wealth and income going to the top, while almost everybody else is feeling increasingly economically stressed, that wealth and income at the top turns itself into political power, either directly through campaign contributions and lobbying or indirectly through the machines of propaganda. And this is not new historically. This is not new in America. But it means that it's harder for people to know the truth. It's harder for average people to come together and say, of course, we need the courts. Of course, we need liability laws and tort laws. Of course, we need OSHA and protections, and we need regulations that maintain health and safety and the environment. And our enemies are not the government. I mean, the government, if it's working as it should be working, is working for us. The issue is not the size of the government. The issue is who government is working for.
That there is that tension between free market and government, as you point out in your book. Government is not necessarily bad.
Well, government is necessary to have a market. Yeah. I think that's point number 1A. Mm-hmm. If you don't have government, you can't have a market. But the second point is that you've got to make sure the government is working for all of us and not for just an elite. That's called an oligarchy or a plutocracy. Yeah. Or, you know, through history we've had different names. But whatever the name is, it's a small group of people who are raking in most of the money, most of the power, and leaving the rest of us high and dry.
This takes us to a tweet that we've just received, which reads, as long as Citizens United is in place, can real economic change happen?
We've got to definitely, the next president has got to appoint justices who will reverse Citizens United, or we've got to do it by constitutional amendment. But we can't just sit on our hands until that happens. We can't assume nothing else is possible. We can agitate for full disclosure of all of the sources of campaign money. We can make sure there's public financing. We can make sure that the revolving door between government and business and Wall Street is slowed down. We can make sure that gerrymandering is stopped, have a citizens commission that is in charge of the districting. Some states are doing that already. In other words, we can take steps to reclaim our democracy and our economy. And anybody who's listening to this who is so cynical about politics they don't want to get involved, you are part of the problem.
Because?
Because you're not getting involved. In other words, the only way we can solve this is the same way that progressives solved it in 1901, the same way that Jacksonians solved it in the 1930s, the same way that a lot of people came together in the 1930s. It's the 1830s and 1930s, incidentally. And that is by coming together and creating a political movement.
Of course, part of that problem is the fact that it's the politicians themselves who are the beneficiaries of Citizens United, if you will, who would have to affect a lot of the kind of change that you're talking about.
But that's precisely because that's why you need countervailing power, Don. In other words, the establishment inside baseball candidates, whether they're Republican or Democrat, are not going to make the changes that are required because of the very point you made. They are there because the system works for them. It's the same with the big CEOs and the big Wall Street banks that are much bigger today than they were before. In fact, I just want to insert this fact because people don't know it and it's important, that in 2007, before the Wall Street crash, when the banks were too big to fail, the five biggest Wall Street banks had 25% of all banking assets in the United States. Today, the five biggest Wall Street banks have 44% of all of America's banking assets. So if they were too big to fail in 2008, they are twice as big now, and we do have to bust them up.
Let's take another call again on this general area. We'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Reich. I've been listening to you for over a decade.
Oh, I'm sorry for you, Jerry.
No, and just to make the point that you made, when you don't vote, you give someone else their vote twice the power. I worked in the airline industry, and we went through all this kind of stuff 30 years ago. And, of course, I wake up this morning, and one of the lead stories on MSN is that the Central States Pension Fund is going to cut benefits up to 25% for some people who are already retired. And it kind of drives me that I'm sure that could be bailed out by the government for a fraction of what it costs to bail out the banks. But it is never framed in that way. And I think the average person still votes against their economic self-interest. I spent 10 days in France last month, and I'm looking around with the phrase of Bobby Jindal at this the European nightmare. And I no one calls him to task for a man who's the governor of one of the states with the highest poverty rates in the country making such an absurd statement. And I don't know. I don't know why people continue to, again, vote against their own economic self-interest or assert their right as a citizen for them to be protected against predatory capitalism.
Well, I think that there are two reasons that people don't vote against. They vote against their economic self-interest. Number one, they're divided by some very clever propaganda divides us by race, by ethnicity, by religion, and so that we can't see the economic self-interest. We're blinded by these kind of hateful divisions, many of them merchants of hate. But the second reason is that people don't connect the dots. They don't have an opportunity. They are overwhelmed with a different kind of economic propaganda that says, for example, there is something called the free market, and which do you trust more, the free market or government? And government is obviously filled, according to this propaganda, with bureaucrats who don't care about you. Well, again, I want to stress to people who are listening that the real issue is not government versus market, because you can't have a market without government. The real question is whether those who are making the rules by which the market functions have you in mind or are doing it and seeing their job basically as to design the market in such a way that it helps the people at the top. Your example, airlines. Airlines continue to go into bankruptcy. What do? They abrogate their union contracts. They come out of bankruptcy. The CEOs have even more money than before. The top executives are doing better than ever. Passengers aren't doing so well. In fact, we used to have, 12 years ago, we had 9 major airlines. We're down to 4 major airlines. Many hubs have only 1 or 2. That means there's collusion. There's not enough competition. Why is it that even though we have low fuel prices now, those low fuel prices are not reflected in airline tickets? It's because of collusion, because monopoly power in airlines. Why do you pay so much for internet service? Americans pay more for internet service than the citizens of any other nation, because 80% of us don't have any choice in terms of internet service provider. And why is that? A lot of it has to do with politics and power.
I'd like to, as time begins to wind down for us, you have a lot of ideas for correcting the situation in your book, many of which you've mentioned already. I'll just mention some of them very quickly here. Reverse Citizens United, get big money out of politics, obviously. Transparency, 5-year ban on public officials lobbying, former public officials joining lobbying firms or organizations that do business with the government, and gerrymandering. Raise the minimum wage to half the median wage. That's an interesting one.
That's the way it was up until the late 60s, early 1970s, Don. The minimum wage was half the median wage in this country. And then it started to drop. Well, we have to bring it back because it's good for people. It's good for the economy. If people have money in their pockets, they can turn around and buy more, which creates more jobs. And it's also a moral principle. As we talked about before, if somebody's working full-time, they should not be in poverty.
If that were instituted today, what would the minimum wage be?
That minimum wage would be, in order to get people out of poverty, obviously it's a slightly different calculation in different parts of the country, but basically it would be about $13 an hour. Most places in the country would be $15 an hour, and that would be the federal minimum. You could go higher if you were a high wage and high cost part of the country.
There is another point here, and this will be our last one because of time considerations. I find this most interesting, and that is having a situation whereby 18-year-olds upon reaching that age would be given a stipend, a monthly stipend, to use to help boost the economy and to be creative, I think, is the way you put it in the book. Well, that sounds like a socialist
Well, it would come out – well, it's not socialism. I don't know what these isms really mean. Yeah. I mean, we're getting to a point where technology and new gadgets are going to take over more and more jobs. So we have to think creatively about a minimum basic income. That's not enough to put everybody in a position of comfort. Obviously not. People are still going to have to work. But just to avoid abject poverty. And as more and more machines do more and more and robots do more and more – we're going to be forced to be creative. It's not bad. That's not socialism. That's not an any-ism. That's just practical reality.
But if the government is granting this stipend, which I assume is what you're talking about.
Well, the question is where the money comes from. And saying is that you would take the patent protection that is going to be guarding all these new technologies, which are really the valuable source of new property. And instead of imposing a huge tax on the wealthy, you just take a percentage of the revenues from patents and you distribute it on a per capita basis. You don't even – in fact, you know, this idea that I'm advancing is not – a lot of conservatives, von Hayek and Milton Friedman and others, have supported a minimum basic income. This is something that is really a very right-wing or conservative idea, although it sounds coming out of my mouth like it's not.
Well, the book has so many ideas and so many things to talk about and think about. I would certainly recommend it. The book is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. Robert Reich will be discussing that book tonight at Maryville University at 7 o'clock at the University Auditorium. I'm sure you're going to have a big crowd and an opportunity to spend more time talking to them than was the case here today with us. But we're grateful that you were able to spend the time with us, Robert Reich.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Coming up, presidential debates. Do they really matter? This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.